And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website, podcastufo.com, for past episodes, blog. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, everyone. This is Martin Willis, your host, and we have Alejandro Rojas coming up to do the news in just a bit. Well, I have some bad news and I have some good news. The bad news is I had something come up last weekend and I could not make it down to Maryland to see Ray Stanford and go through all his things at his house and all that I was going to do and do a podcast down there. It was going to be a recorded podcast. So the good news is it's going to be a live show instead with Ray this evening. And he is a longtime researcher. And I assure you that Ray is going to boggle your mind. It's going to be well worth listening to. And I want to thank everyone for their support. And if you want to subscribe to hear the second part of the show, go to getjoyride.com. All that information is right on our sidebar on our website, podcastufo.com. And let's see, how you doing, Alejandro? I actually have to clear the air about something.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
You're setting me up so you can take me down, aren't you?
Well, you know, you were off in Las Vegas last week, and you were doing who knows what with who knows who, and I was sitting here alone, feeling empty. Mm-hmm. One thing led to another, and the next thing you know, I had Ryan Sprague on the show. I'm sorry.
Sprague. Did I tell you that's how I like to say his name, too? Because it reminds me of Prague.
Yeah. So you're not upset? Because, you know, he really means nothing to me, and I was thinking about you the whole time. You know,
Oh, no, I am upset.
Oh, okay.
And well, you both are in big trouble.
Well, you know, people get through this sort of thing, and I really think we can put it behind us.
Next time I see him, I'm going to pull that short hair of his and slap him.
Okay. Hey, you know, it's funny. I got an email from an sort of an angry listener. But, you know, when someone's really angry and they're listening, they really don't have to listen. That's how I put it. But anyway, it's like, hey, you joke around. We need someone out there that takes the UFO topic seriously.
Yeah.
So I expect the rest. Either I'm going to apologize to him right now or I'm going to keep doing it the way I want to do it.
So I should do like Seinfeld does on that episode where he was trying not to be funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and he's all just, oh, man. This UFO thing is just getting so crazy.
It really is.
I don't know what's going on. And, you know, nobody seems to care. Unfortunately, I can't do it, though. I'm trying here, and I just have fun. I'm excited to be talking to you. I'm excited to be talking to your listeners. I'm excited to be sharing this news. And it's not, you know what, something that we have to get so solemn and freaked out about. I'm sorry. I've been doing this full time for a long time. And I could have a terrible, grumpy life where I'm just upset because I don't feel people are taking the field seriously. Or I can, you know, kind of cruise along and do my thing and hopefully not burn out as soon as many others.
That's true.
Do, because burnout does happen in this field, as you know.
It seems to. Hey, you're preaching to the choir here, so.
Well, and, you know, I had a good buddy who he's an older gentleman now, and he's, you know, he saw UFOs in the 60s and everything. And he used to put it this way. Even if there is some sort of disclosure or they make themselves appear, you're still going to have to go to work the next day. You're still going to have to pay your bills. I think, you know, this is my livelihood. But I think a lot of people make a little bit too much out of all this. I mean, we still have life to live. If there is some others out there, hopefully we can one day communicate. But that doesn't mean, you know, it's got to rule our lives or destroy our lives. Personally, I take a lot more issues more seriously, like you know, all the death and homelessness and hunger throughout the world. I think that's something that is much more serious of an issue.
I absolutely, and you know, it kind of makes me wonder if the doomsdayers, let's say, or people that are really thinking that the whole thing is going to crash when aliens come here, if they sort of want to have a relief from life and think that, wow, you know, maybe if this happens, life won't have to go on. I won't have to pay the bills. I won't have to do this. Who knows? I don't know the, you know, the psychological part of that, but it is kind of interesting how people think that life won't go on.
Yeah, I think you make a good point. And I really, there's been some studies out when I talk about, I do this lecture on UFOs and religion, and I've written about it in the magazine. And there are studies that have been done, you know, that show that religions are really not going to freak out. They're going to be able to handle this information. Studies show that at least 50% of the people out there, well, 30 to 50%, maybe higher, you know, believe that there's something to the UFO phenomena. I don't think people are going to freak out that much. Of course, it depends on the nature of if we get attacked or something.
Yeah, that would make a difference, wouldn't it?
But yeah, so we're going to have to keep on, you know, struggling and working on our issues. I don't, you know, we're not going to have this big overnight change regardless of what happens. So I've had that comment before occasionally. Oh, I should be more serious. But you know what? Even if I could get more serious about it, which unfortunately I'm just not capable of, I would have a much more miserable life, and I don't want that.
Yeah, who does? Yeah. Well, what do we have going on?
Bakersfield, California. So in Bakersfield, 23 ABC News had written about this a couple of weeks ago. I did a story on it, and we had written about it, and it was a very nice lady, the reporter. She even replied and thanked us for doing a story, which was kind of cool. But she wrote about how on February 14th and March 14th, there were UFO sightings. And on the March 14th sighting, there was a blue light in the sky that was recorded just for a few seconds by some of the residents in Bakersfield, California. And I think this is a really interesting video. People should check this out. I don't know what it might be. But so everybody was kind of looking forward to April 14th to see if there would be another UFO sighting, and lo and behold, there was. It was a cloudy night, and this gentleman captured a picture of a light in the clouds. Unfortunately, it's very different than the other sightings, and it's much less interesting in my humble opinion. I think that, you know, many have speculated it's just the lights from an airplane. And I think that is what it is. So I'm not so sure that this is an actual, you know, genuine UFO. I think this is one's kind of identified. But it's still interesting. And, of course, you know, I talked to Jason about this, and he made the point that doesn't mean there weren't UFOs. This is a cloudy night. So there may have been a return. Just people weren't able to see them. So this is kind of a neat story, and the other videos besides this one were much more interesting, but this story has kind of gotten big, of course, in California, and it's done well on our site as well.
Huh. All right. So if I'm catching this right, she was expecting them to come because they always come on that date?
So there were sightings on February 14th, and there were sightings on March 14th.
Oh,
so,
I see.
Yeah, everybody was waiting to see if there were going to be sightings again on April 14th.
Do you think, you know, either one or two things, you know, they had to pay their taxes the next day, so they didn't show up, or they really don't have a calendar?
A lot of people say, well, why would they come on the calendar day? They don't have calendars. Another point that's been made is that people see UFOs a lot in California. By the numbers, not by population, but by the numbers, California has the most UFO reports. So that could be just coincidental that there were two. I'm sure if you go to the MUFON database of UFO reports or to the NUFORC database of UFO reports, you would be able to draw conclusions like you would probably be able to see in Bakersfield. Maybe every month on the 10th, there was a sighting for the last year because there's so many sightings reported. So it could just be a coincidence.
You know, another thing about California is I lived there for 9 years, and you're outside a lot more than you are, you know, in other parts of the country. Of course, you are as well in Phoenix, but not so much in the summer at night. I mean, doesn't it get real hot?
It gets real hot, but people, we still have clear skies. And I think that's one of the reasons that by population, Arizona is usually like in the top couple of states. Sometimes it's the very top. So, and I agree with you. I think it's because people are outside and the skies are clear more often.
Righto. Righto. So what else is happening?
So another story, and I'm going to go kind of in the by the date, but this is a fun one. I think that is really interesting. So these scientists published a story about findings on their search for advanced alien civilizations. And this is kind of funny because some news stories, and you've probably seen this more, have said scientists looked for aliens at 100,000 galaxies and they didn't find any.
Right.
But then there's other stories, and you might not realize this is the same story. Other headlines, and there's very few of these, but have said scientists find 50 galaxies where aliens probably live. Both of them are over-exaggerations of what actually was discovered. And it's unfortunate because the major news stories are kind of going with that 100,000 one, and that is completely, absolutely inaccurate if you look at the details of the study. So that what the study decided to do was the WISE satellite from NASA is able to look at the radiation coming from different galaxies. They decided to examine the data from 100,000 galaxies to determine if the radiation is higher than the light should produce. And they figure out, you know, it, just like us, we create a lot of heat with our computers and all of our technology. So we've got more heat coming out of us than we should have. And they figure that heat might mean an advanced alien civilization. Now, one of the markers they were looking for are what are called like a Kardashev, I think they call it. Some of you may be familiar with this, but the type 2, type 3 civilizations. And this idea is a type 1 civilization is able to harness the power from their planet. A type 2 can harness the energy of a star. A type 3 harnesses the energy of their entire galaxy.
Yeah, Jeffrey Bennett mentioned this.
Bennett talks about it. Michio Kaku talks about this. A lot of scientists do. Really interesting. But what they were looking for is this type 3. So they were thinking if we can see a galaxy that has very little light and high radiation, that would mean that this is a civilization that is harnessing all of the energy of the galaxy. And so we can't see any light because they're using like probably Dyson spheres where they surround their stars with solar panels that are collecting all of the energy. So it's this idea around human technology. And it's a really far-fetched idea in the first place, and it assumes they would have technology like us. So they didn't find evidence of a Kardashev Type 3. So they didn't find evidence that aliens are using the energy from their stars, which is much different than saying we didn't find any advanced alien civilizations. In fact, even though they didn't find the radiations high enough and the light low enough to be a type 3, they did find galaxies that had more radiation than they should. And that's where the 50 galaxies comes in, because they did find 50 galaxies that had more radiation than they should. They did. They found 45 other anomalies of radiation that should have more than it has. They figure some of these are things that they can understand, but some of them are genuine mysteries. So, you know, one of the scientists, for instance, says, wow, we found these 50 galaxies. We need to look into this, and SETI needs to help us because maybe there's advanced civilizations there. But, of course, a lot of the media is saying, oh, they didn't find aliens, which is like I explained. More accurate would be they didn't find any aliens that are harnessing the energy of all of their stars and putting solar panels around their stars. So
what
that would be more accurate.
Absolutely confusing report. It just
It is confusing, and I lay it out better in the story so you could read it. But what's interesting is Freeman Dyson, the guy who came up with the Dyson spheres, he was like, when he read this and saw, you know, they didn't find evidence of Dyson spheres, he was like, that's cool. That was just, you know, one theory, one hypothesis. That doesn't mean there's not aliens. It just means that if they are out there, at least in these 100,000 galaxies, they might not be using this technology that I conceived of. But others argue that perhaps if their technology is so advanced, they don't have any footprint whatsoever. They're not emitting any more radiation than they would otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, we're always thinking in human terms, and mm-hmm. we have absolutely no idea what an advanced civilization is capable of. So, you know, that's a problem with SETI, and it's better than doing nothing, but still the fact remains that we're just out there guessing, really.
Yeah, exactly. So, but what is exciting is looking at the glass half full from our perspective, because we're excited that there would be a discovery of an advanced civilization, is that there are anomalies and that there are 50 galaxies out there where at least some of these scientists are pushing to be observed more closely to find out if there is a civilization there.
You know, Ray's going to get mad at us. We probably ought to only do one more story.
Yeah, cool. And I've only got one more to talk about.
Oh, okay.
Brand new. I just posted this story just a few minutes ago. It's already creating some controversy. If you go to my Facebook, you'll see I'm debating with this MUFON researcher about it. And this is really interesting. There's this lady who on April 18th caught a UFO floating, kind of fluttering and zooming around above a building in Virginia Beach. And it's at the Virginia Beach Town Center above the Westin, which is the tallest building in Virginia. It's about 510 feet high. So this video looks really cool. Some people have suggested a bird, but it sits there for a while before it zooms one way, zooms the other way, sits there for a while again. And then others have suggested that perhaps it's a drone. That's what I'm debating with the MUFON guy about. That's entirely possible. I don't think we can rule that out. But it doesn't seem to have any lights on it. It's 510 feet in the air just sitting there. And this is like at midnight. So that seems unlikely. I mean, you would think if you have your drone up there, in order to see it, you would have lights on it. And this thing gets dimmer as it moves away from the building until you can't see it at all when it's a certain distance away from the building. So I'm not so sure about the drone idea personally. I guess it's still a possibility. But yeah, you guys got to check it out. Plus, the way it moves is really weird. And it really reminds me of this video that was given to me several years ago of this weird object that kind of did the same thing over the Las Vegas Strip. Some people had told me, well, it might be a bag floating in the wind. But if you watch this thing, it moves up and down. It hovers over this big building, over New York, New York, Empire State Building. And then it floats down to the roller coaster. Really weird videos. So you get the 2-for-1 UFO videos with this story. But really interesting. I'm looking more into it. And I have at least emailed one group that this commenter in YouTube had suggested. And they do film over that area using a drone. So I'm asking them if it's their drone. So that's still a possibility. But if you look at it, at least I don't think that doesn't seem like it is a drone. Maybe it is. But I'd love to get other people's opinions.
Awesome. Well, hey, thanks so much, Alejandro. It's good to have you back home.
It's good to be here, buddy, and sorry for all of my jocularity.
That's fine. I'm going to have to Google that.
Yeah, it means being a goofball.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
I'm surprised I didn't know that because...
Because you're a goofball,
I'm
too.
I'm a goofball. Hey, have a good one, and we'll talking to you next week. So... Hang in there, everyone. After the quick music break, we'll be right back with Ray Stanford.
Thank you.
That is a new clip by Bruce Rainier. Thank you, Bruce. And Ray Stanford, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Ready to go.
Great. You may want to get a little closer to the phone.
Okay.
And thanks so much for joining us. You know, you were on back in July, and thank you so much for being a graceful person and offering to be on the show live when I couldn't make it down there last week. I really appreciate that.
My pleasure.
And we're going to be talking about all kinds of things. Why don't we go over quickly? We don't want to baffle the people listening, but we'll go over quickly what we're going to cover in the first hour, and then possibly in the second hour, time permitting. So why don't you just throw us kind of a an overall what we're going to talk about tonight?
Okay. Actually, I decided that it might be good to give people the discovery background that I come from. That is to say, since the early 1970s, I have been heavily involved with the use of optical and electronic instruments, cameras, movie cameras, dual cameras, spectrographic cameras, recording ELF magnetometer, recording gravimeter, and other fancy equipment to try to get something that can really, well, let's say, be chewed on by the scientific community, that we don't have to take on faith or as hearsay, or speculate about something that is diagnostic. And so I wanted tonight to list and briefly describe at least nine of the specific UFO-related phenomena that we have documented again and again in daylight. And we, my group, my project has always focused, except for in one event, on daylight events, because the films you get are much more interesting and informative than when you're dealing with just bright lights against a black sky. So the first thing that we discovered that really, it wasn't the first thing, but it was the first thing that really set us back. It just absolutely surprised us. That was not anticipated by anything we saw in the literature, is what we call the multi-image phenomenon that occurs around the objects that we are filming, in this case, in broad daylight. Now, let me mention that this particular phenomenon, when you see it on film, you want to film it as fast as you can, as many frames per second as you can, and at a higher, as high as you can. But this is something that if you look at the object in the broad daylight sky, you will not see this phenomenon. Instead, what you will see is actually you look at the object passing across the sky, as a group of hundreds of Boy Scouts did in the 1950s on Catalina Island, and you will see a darker blue around the object than the sky, and it doesn't look like a corona. That's because the individual images of the object that are there in what we call multi-imaging are sequencing at high speed, and your brain, eye and perceptual system are flicker-fusing them into a single image that may seem to slightly vibrate, but will not be segregated into distinct shapes. But when you see them on film, you'll see that these images that pop into view, apparently sequentially and at high speed, are extremely fast. And but you can, well, I'll give you an example. My best filmed example of this was made on February 16th, 1986, when my wife and I were heading into Andrews Air Force Base, just outside the east side of the Washington, D.C., by the way, to have dinner with an Air Force colonel friend of ours and his wife and kids. And we saw something quite incredible. We saw two things that the literature would call from 1950s. They might call it Great Cloud Cigar, but others might call it a mothership. Whatever happened, one of them, when we stopped and got the camera ready to film, very quickly phantomed out like a rheostat turning down a light, but the other remained, and it had objects going to and from it. Well, this was at a time of day when the light, fortunately, of this back lighting of the sky was highly polarized because the sun had just set, and the light in that direction was highly polarized. This is the ideal time to visually segregate these images on your film. It's much more distinct when you're filming in polarized light. And what happened is we got the best film of this that I have ever gotten. I'm thinking, for example, of a frame that I have here on my computer right now, that when you get to counting the images that are visible, I lost track at 400, around 400. They are images of the object itself, but they're all around it, and you get the impression, the way they overlay of each other, that they are sequential, but they are not. They are like the object, but instead of being positive images, they are negative images. That is to say, where it was dark, it will be light, and where it was light, it will be dark. And yet you can see the object not only in almost any position, if you look in at the proper ones that are in spherical patterns around it, but you can also see them much larger than the object itself. And if you just increase the contrast a little bit in looking at this on the computer, I mean, you can make out details in these so-called secondary multi-images that are only vaguely visible in what we call the target object. So this phenomenon is difficult to understand. What's causing it is certainly not stealth, because it doesn't keep one from seeing the target object at all. It's something else entirely. And I would, if I had to guess, and it would be only a guess, I would suggest that it may have something to do that could suggest to us that the object might simultaneously have what physics would call local properties, or normal universes we view it of gross world objects, and simultaneously with that, non-local properties are things that are normally properties that are present in subatomic particles. And I won't go into the other evidence we have that might confirm this, but because at this point it's speculation, but I would bet that in the future, after I'm long gone and people are studying this beyond what I have, that there's going to be a discovery that is regarded as very basic to quantum physics, because we're going to, I believe, determine that these objects can simultaneously, or at least in pulses, alternately be local and non-local. Now, that is a remarkable phenomenon. We have it in thousands and thousands of movie frames and still shots that we've gotten, and all in daylight. A very important one that I might mention is what we call pulsed refraction. This is another one that thrills the physicists who have seen the evidence. For example, on December 4th, 1980, my wife and daughter and I were flying back from Mexico City on a flight to San Antonio, Texas. We were climbing through 12,000 feet. We had passed through a layer of cloud below and would be passing through another one above us, but it's open in between. And we observed and filmed out there what the literature would call a mothership, because it had small objects going to and from it. But I won't go into that detail for a moment, but let me tell the thing that relates to pulsed refraction. The object is out there at a distance. You can tell as I'm filming it. Near clouds, you see them pass by the airliner fast due to our motion to the north. And the more distant clouds and the clouds on the horizon, you see pass very slowly. Likewise, the big mothership and the objects near it. So we have what's called parallax of motion. It clearly shows these are large-sized objects a great distance from the camera. But out there on the horizon, there are mountains sticking out of through the clouds from below, mountaintops. And what is really shocking, what really thrilled me when I saw it, was that on the film, well, let me say, I was filming most of the time at 54 frames per second. It's a movie camera, on film. This is not digital. It's real old-fashioned emulsion film. And at 54 frames a second, you see the mountaintop, and in four frames, three or four frames, I forget which, then four frames, you actually see the mountain optically, the top of the mountain optically flattened out. The mountain's not flattening, but the optical image of the light that's coming from behind is being warped in a way that the image becomes shortened vertically. And this happens for five frames, I believe. I'll take that back, five frames. And then in 15 frames, three times as many frames, it optically grows back up to its normal height. Now, this doesn't occur once or twice. This occurs throughout the film, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of frames. Not only that, And that's right under, that's the mountain that is right under the position in the sky of the so-called mothership with the smaller objects. Now, off to the left, near the edge of the frame, you'll see mountains sticking out of the clouds also. While the mountains below the mothership rise in the few frames that I mentioned, when they collapse optically, the ones over there rise up instead. And when the ones underneath the mothership rise up, they collapse on the left side, the mountains on the left side. So this indicates that we have what appears to be a spheric field of refraction in which there's a differential in the two positions. It's wonderful. It's absolute a wonderful thing for physicists, optical physicists, to handle, because it's things that they can easily handle, and they can calculate the speed of how many arc minutes per second the refraction is reducing the size of the mountain, so forth. In fact, we already have this, and I show it in my PowerPoint presentation. We also have another form of this pulse refraction that is also quite startling. This was recorded way back in my second color motion picture film that I ever got of a UFO. And in this case, it was on July 28, 1959. And there were nine witnesses in my parents' front yard, and we're out there, and we observed and filmed with two cameras simultaneously, an 8 and a 16-millimeter camera, what the literature would call great cloud cigar motherships. There were four of these that appeared, and they had often objects going to and from them. We got that. But remarkably, after a while, a jet at high altitude came, apparently ordered to do a reconnaissance run on this high-altitude mothership. It's all on film, and you see the contrail of the jet, the vapor trail, go toward the object, and then you see that it turns to curve around the object as if it were making a prescribed reconnaissance run, probably had a gun camera or something operating. In any case, what is really shocking is that when the jet gets near the object, all of a sudden, two things happen. The so-called mothership, if you want to call it that, suddenly, instantly changes shape, and it seems to condense itself into a triangular object that another place is dark black instead. But in the process of doing this, you see that this jet vapor trail, the jet that's curving down toward, around the object, I should say, instead of seeing one of them, there are actually five other images of that trail in visible in pulses. So you have apparently, and I would suggest that because of the shutter speed, these may not have been simultaneous images. One may have been at one location, and the next moment in the exposure, they were at another. But the point is, the film recorded pulsed refraction, just like the Mexico film years later. So here we have evidence that has never been talked about in the literature, but the kind of thing that should make it into major scientific physical science journals. There's a lot of other things, but I'll slow down here and see if there's anything you want to ask me before I go on.
Oh, yes. First of all, thank you for all that information. You know, when you were starting to talk about this, the first thing that came to mind in my speculation was, is there any type of interdimensional thing going on here? Is that another thing you thought of, or you think it's strictly along the lines of this refraction?
Well, I hesitate to bring in interdimensional discussion because, in the first place, we have to have a definition of what one means by that. And the only people that really understand this are the theoretical physicists that are dealing with it with mathematics. And I know a lot of people in metaphysics are taking up this and claiming, oh, yes, these are interdimensional, blah, blah, blah. Well, they may be, but what do they mean by that?
Yeah,
Us a definition, you see. And what I prefer to deal with, Martin, is to look at what is physically there. We can show evidence that there is a glow that's brighter than the sunlight. There's a plasma there, and that there is refraction there. And to deal directly with what we can get a handle on without going into theoretical physics at a level that we do not have adequate data to deal with.
Sure. Now, when I was out in Phoenix, I sat for quite a while and had a really nice discussion. I really enjoyed speaking with Chris O'Brien. He's
yes,
someone you've known for years, and he's been on the show last April, a year ago. So Chris was telling me that he saw this particular film you were just talking about, And he said it really blew his mind. He said from one frame, this object was in one place. In the next frame in the film, unaltered film, it was in a total different spot, you know, instantly, which is at 54 frames a second is really an amazing feat.
Yes. Well, this was the film that was taken as we were climbing through 12,000 feet north of Mexico City. The pilot told me that at the time, the beginning of this event, that we were flying over the Tizayuca omnidirectional radio beacon north of Mexico City. So we have an exact place where about the time I started filming what was visible off the left window of the plane. Let me mention that there is another very, very important phenomenon that was recorded in that amazing film. And I have recorded this very nicely in two different films, but that was the best one. What happened is, well, there's one frame. This is just was published in November of 2013 at a major physical science conference in Moscow, presented by a major world-class theoretical physicist. And but what happened is, at that point, at the what would be the north end of this large mothership that was out there, there were other objects. But there was a disc-shaped object out at the right end, the north end of this mothership. And all of a sudden, in a single frame, it's gone. But you see it there, but the next frame, it's not there. And when it in that frame where it starts to go, you see a beautiful array of 20-some-odd concentric light and dark rings. Now, these are not rings that are just perfect circles in the photo plane. Those could easily be explained as artifacts. No, these are exactly in parallel with the tilt out of the photo plane of the body, the disc-shaped body of the object itself. You can see that the light and dark ovals or ellipses are parallel to the actual plane, as though they are from an effect that is radial to the symmetric plane of the object. It is just beautiful. It tilts substantially out of the vertical and downward to the left side of it, downward exactly like the disc. It's just, a physicist would say it's mouthwatering. This is stuff they can eat with their minds, and several of them have and been really thrilled. In fact, that's why that particular physicist, when he saw this, when I showed it at a secret conference we had in Bavaria in Germany a few years back, he asked me, please promise me, can I use this in a scientific paper? And I said, yes, indeed. And this was well received by the group, the scientist. This is an international conference. It was in Moscow in November of 2013, but there were scientists from all over the world. And most of these talks are so specialized that you'll have only a few people can even understand them, and so a few people that show up. But because of the subject, he announced that his subject was evidence of strong magnetic fields in these objects. Not only were all the seats filled, they were standing around the walls and out the door. And he had received an email from the head of the Soviet Academy of Sciences that said, I wish I could make it, but I can't. My wife and I are on vacation the week you're going to do this. Well, however, he decided he better come anyway, and he came and walked in and was just thrilled. And the scientist that produced this, that showed this, said that there was no negative reaction at all, that people were genuinely interested and asked excellent questions, and there was no one throwing mud or saying this is absurd. Well, he showed not only an enlarged print of the Faraday rings from the film, but he also showed several analog graphs that we have made of these objects when we recorded their extreme low-frequency magnetic field, and also showed what's called a Fourier analysis that analyzes the frequencies and magnitude of the signals. So this is the kind of thing you see that you're not talking ghosts and goblins. You're talking about things that physicists can understand and get their teeth into. But anyway, that was all the same film from Mexico.
Wow. Ray, I want to talk a little bit more about scientists in just a minute. But you mentioned just a minute ago that you spoke with the pilot to get the bearings of where this was filmed. Did the pilot himself actually see the object?
I do not know. What I understand that pilots are very hesitant to talk. Now, in one major event, 12-12-77, the pilot not only contacted me, as did a stewardess from the airline, that he literally brought his wife to Austin to see the movie and the enlargement from it, and confessed to me that not only had he seen it, but that it was so awesome that he followed the rules and turned the airliner about 10 degrees off J-42 because he was a little apprehensive of this brilliant, incredible object. And in this case, though, what I did, I simply sent a note up via the stewardess to the pilot, and I asked him, I said, can you tell me where we were located, the above-ground location, at? And I gave him the time. And, of course, he had to know that, something was odd that I would even ask this. But he simply sent a note back and told me at that moment we were flying over the Tizayuca omnidirectional radio beacon. So I don't know in that case whether the pilot actually saw it, as in the other case happened.
Uh-huh. Ray, I don't want to get too far off track, but just to tell the listening audience, you're a very renowned dinosaur tracker, and you are near Goddard Space Center. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because you actually know a number of people there. Has any one of these scientists actually seen any of this, the film evidence that you have?
Oh, sure. In fact, for example, there's a major scientist that, for example, this scientist, you can truly call him a rocket scientist. He designed, I think there's 7 or 11, maybe or 7, 8 or 8 actual cesium ion engines used in maneuvering spacecraft out in deep space. And he has, I believe, 7 instruments in which he participated in the major design on the recently orbited MAVEN orbiter around Mars, studying the upper atmosphere. And he has seen them and been extremely enthusiastic and encouraging me about this. And also there's a major, a chief scientist at Goddard that has also seen this, most everything that I have, and is very thrilled. And he keeps reminding me, he flies frequently on NASA business, and he keeps reminding me that now every flight he makes, he watches out the window as long as he can and keeps his camera ready.
Now, when you talk to people like this, do you think they actually speak to other people about it, or do you think they kind of just keep it to themselves?
I think it really depends on the individual. Each one is an individual. Some of them are talkative, and others are a little more shy. I've showed this to a lot more people, too. I'm not going to name any of them, but there are a lot of people that are really enthusiastic. In fact, even as I addressed on February 1st, 2013, at Goddard, I was asked to present my dinosaur material to the what's called the NASA Goddard Science Colloquia Lecture Series, and I did. Well, we have reason to believe that I will probably get accepted to present something that might at least half jokingly and half seriously be titled "What the Goddard Dinosaur Tracker Tracks When He's Looking Up Instead of Down." And I say Goddard Dinosaur Tracker simply because I was I discovered dinosaur tracks there that no one knew were there, and then the whole center got very excited. The head scientist of all the scientists there was over here, and he told me that he was virtually brought to poetry about this. He said he kept thinking about how, well, that old notosaur was walking right there with his tracks so visible. Now, back then, the light was just originating, and he had found out which distant star system was the one that was far enough away to have covered that many million, I think it was 87 million years ago. And he said it was such a wonderful thing, and to think that here at the Space Center, where people are thinking, looking up and traveling into space, they're also walking right over dinosaur tracks day by day, as one astrophysicist who also saw a lot of this material, he said to me, he said, you know, 5 days a week for 3.5 years, I had walked within 6 or 7 feet of that big dinosaur track, and I never knew it. And I said, that's because you're one in your work who looks up, not down.
Yeah,
and kidding him, of course.
And who knows how many tracks the Space Center was built on, actually, too. You never
know. There are a lot of them. Unfortunately, of course, when they make the basements of buildings and the parking lots, all this stuff gets destroyed, but I guarantee you people are being a lot more careful now that has happened.
Yeah, that's right. Now, the beam ahead, I want to talk a little bit about that, because that, reading Chris Lambright's book, X Descending, and he talks about Mirabeau, and you had this connection with him about this beam ahead and a possible possible propulsion through. It makes a lot of sense. He made sense out of it and actually did some scientific research on it. Can you talk about that as well?
Yes, yes. Now, this this was something that I found that was, apparently, I think there were hundreds of people that must have seen this. There were hundreds out at the park that day when my two eldest kids and I and three adults on the pier saw, and I filmed it. And we also learned from the newspaper that a little boy, 11 years old, or 12, I think he was 11, in town actually saw and photographed one of the objects as well. But what was happening with the first seven of the eight objects that in a procession came over horizontally and then turned in an almost straight up disappearing with distance, almost straight up going overhead, was that I only had film four of them in my camera. But what happened is they had, counterintuitively, you have a disc-shaped object with a dome on one side, but believe it or not, these objects were flying with their flat, what we would think of as the bottom of the disc, forward in the direction of travel. And that that particular side, I mean, it's a marvelous, you're going to have to see it, Martin, when you come here. But when you see the blue-green emitters off the rim spiraling around it and the incredible pink hexagon that is across the bottom of this thing, and then in the midst of it, there is a tower. You can see physical structure of the tower and even make out some triangular devices attached to it. But in pulses, the tower would fill with plasma, apparently, and then it would project it in a very narrow column out ahead of it up to about 30 object diameters. And when you see the presentation, yeah, I mean, it's just wonderful because, well, in the first place, even before we had these image enhanced where you can see the most wonderful details of how the plasma is moving in different areas along the beam, even before that, I mean, you plainly see on the raw film, as Chris Lambite said in his wonderful book, you see that something most remarkable is going on, and that apparently what I interpreted even at that time when I first saw the film was that that it's communicating with the air. This is an electrified beam. This is a plasma beam, and it projects out there, electrifies the air in front. It has its own magnetic field because it has the plasma flowing down it outward, so it has its own magnetic field, and as it electrifies the air in front of it, it causes the air to move to the side, and it gets stronger the closer it is to the source, the object itself, and the tower in the center of the what we would think of as the bottom of the object, but actually it's the forward side of the object. And you actually can see this happening, that the air is being moved around, and when it gets near the object, you can actually see in what we would call the Schlieren tonalities in the atmosphere, the light and dark patterns of flow due to the plasma and the different changes in the amount of plasma there. You can see exactly how when it gets in that strong field right at the object, it just grabs it finally and moves it completely around it and closes it back and back. And I want to encourage people to realize that Chris Lambite's book is the first book using this evidence. It shows that for the first time in history, UFO knowledge based on this film has been used to the benefit of humankind, in that I showed this in Austin to Chris, and I showed it to a graduate student there that just got his master's degree and was going up to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute to get his PhD in aerospace engineering. And I said, look, I believe this is what's happening. This is how these objects can travel much faster than the speed of sound without ever having to push a sonic shockwave in front of them that thus makes a sonic boom, and so we don't hear any sonic booms. And he agreed with me. He said, it's exactly what it looks like is happening. Well, he went up to Rensselaer, and I moved up here to Maryland from Texas. And in the early spring of 1987, I got a call from him, and he said, would you mind if I brought my professor in charge of my PhD program here down to see this? We're coming to an advanced propulsion conference at Goddard Space Flight Center. And he said, I'd like for him to see this, and he explained it to him. Well, he was thrilled. They spent more time here than at the advanced propulsion conference, and at least three times he thanked me, and my wife, fortunately, was here the last time he thanked me and said, Ray, I want to thank you because this week you have given your government a quantum leap through the atmosphere and into space. And then he said to me, he said, but there's a problem. He said, you know, I told you I was here because I am designing a magnetohydrodynamic dish-shaped aerodyne to be powered by a beam from the ground for the U.S. Air Force. But he said, what you showed today and this week and explained in detail will enable it to move much more efficiently through the atmosphere. But he said, I have an embarrassing question. He said, well, you're going to design this, and it's going to have the plasma whirling around it in response to the magnetic field. But we don't know how to land it because you open those landing gear out into this whirling magnetic field and you get chaos and it could wreck the craft and kill the pilots. I said, well, sure, but let me tell you how they do it. And I showed him a drawing from a case, a multi-witness case in Puerto Rico. And he showed that the landing gear, he showed it landed on the ground, but instead of being on the rim where an aerodynamicist would place it, it was they were opening out of the middle where a plasma physicist, knowing that its magnetodynamic repel would place it, because there it can open in the quiet of the magnetic vent instead of in the swirl of the plasma round and off of the magnetic torus. And so as a result, I got a call 2 days later after they got back up to Rensselaer, and Scott, the graduate student, said, he said, Ray, he said, you should have seen Professor Malvo. He ran up the stairs at 2:30 in the morning, drew the new schema for the landing gear, and sent it immediately, electronically, to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Air Technical Intelligence Center, Dayton, Ohio. And indeed, he did. In fact, Marbo followed through, and when a few weeks later he presented this with the new schema for the landing gear at another scientific conference here in D.C., he sent me also a copy, as he had given me the other book before about the craft. He sent me the one showing the drawing of the modified landing gear, because I was the one that told him how to do it based on what I had learned about these objects. So what I wanted to say is, if people want to talk to people to make people believe that this is, but forget the idea of convincing people these are aliens or anything like that. Show them that the study of this object, these kinds of objects, can benefit humankind by advancing our aerospace technology. And if you want to prove that, I suggest you be real generous and spend the only $9.70. Go to X Descending website, or even on Amazon.com, and you can buy Chris Lambright's book. Hey, man, you've got the kind of ammunition to show that this subject has finally paid off scientifically, because he proves conclusively by documents, very good investigator, that this thing is what gave him the breakthrough, that he did not have an idea of how to do this before, and that this is what how he learned it, right here at my place, seeing excerpts from this film. So I suggest everybody that wants to be able to talk real practical sense about this research, get Chris Lambright's book. It's an electronic book. Study it and learn to talk the language that has a meaning to the external world beyond those that just want to believe in alien visitation.
Yeah, I highly endorse that book as well. You know, Chris is a good friend, but, you know, I read the book before I even talked to Chris, and I was glued to that, you know, both about the Paul Benowitz case and also about the second part of it. Yeah, about your different videos, and this in particular is really fascinating how this whole thing came together. And it's, if this is a major breakthrough, and you know, in the future becomes a part of how we power our spacecraft and things like that. You were actually a little piece of that. How does that make you feel?
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question. What was it?
How do you feel about, you may actually become part of a history of space history?
Oh, well, I feel very good about that. The truth is when I was a little kid, I wanted to grow up, and the only way I knew to propel things at that time was rockets. And through high school, I designed and built rather large rockets. These are not these little models you buy in stores. I mean, the largest one that we launched was just huge. I mean, we had some pretty remarkable four-stage rockets, and I wanted to go into aerospace engineering, but when I had an encounter on Sunday night, October 21, 1956, and other encounters too, that convinced me there was something better than rockets, I then said, wait a minute, I can't go into rocket engineering. But then it took all these years until I got that film in 1980 that I was really able to make the contribution through Professor Merrill Bow that I want. And let me say this. People say, oh, man, aren't you angry that Marabou hasn't admitted that he got this idea? No, I didn't ask him to do so. I merely wanted to show him. I wanted to give a gift to humankind that would advance our propulsive technique and hopefully get us into space more rapidly and more easily. And I have this naive, perhaps, belief that as we see a greater universe and the Earth from a greater distance, we may become more cognizant of the silliness of localized fighting and try and move ourselves out into a more cosmic position in relationship to life in general. But I want to say, regardless of whether he ever will acknowledge where he got the idea, but Chris proves it, the thing is, it is to his eternal credit as a scientist and a major aerospace scientist that he open-mindedly came here and looked and responded. He even begged a colleague of his in California to come out, and the guy just refused. He said, I wouldn't believe anybody claims he filmed a UFO, but he tried to get him to come. But what I'm saying is, let's not blackball him because he hasn't said this is where it came from. Let's credit him with having the courage and the guts to come here and listen and look.
Right. Yeah, I totally. And how did he first catch wind of this whole thing? I can't recall
okay.
that part.
The student that came, he had gotten his bachelor's at Rice University in Texas. He got his master's at the University of Texas, Austin. And then he went up to Rensselaer, the best probably school in the world for aerospace studies, and had Professor Marabou as the professor that's over his PhD program there. And so he got to talking to him, and he said, look, in the first place, he learned Professor Marabou was under contract, that he had designed, in fact, already, a saucer-shaped aerodyne, magnetohydynamic aerodyne that electrifies the air, moves it magnetohydynamically, magnetoplasmodynamically, if you prefer, that's powered from the ground. In fact, in appreciation of what I told Marabou, he gave me, and you can't buy them, I have an inch-thick volume just showing the details of the construction of this this craft, the initial design of it, and so on. And then there's the secondary one that shows the proper placement of the landing gear. And someone asked me the other day said, well, gee, this was 1987, what's been done? Well, the truth of the matter is, as of 2 years ago, I had a link, I have it somewhere, Marabou was out there with a very advanced shielded laboratory, portable laboratory, that costs millions of dollars, and is shielded because it's in a Faraday cage that will protect them from the microwave, potential microwave scatter when they launch this microwave-powered object by a beam from the ground. And it's portable so that they need to go to a different location to do the testing of the disc, but they are out there testing them. They've had this system, this unit to be at the launch site for several years now, and I can assure you that they're out there testing and surely flying some of these things around. And just the other day I saw another release on the Internet showing how they now are thinking they will power this not just from the ground, but can power it from space even better, from a satellite with a microwave beam, and it shows the thing flying along with the beam head on it, just exactly as I taught Marabou to do.
Wow, how about that? We only have a few minutes left to the top of the first hour here, so I just want to ask you a question a little bit off topic of what we're talking about. And first of all, if anyone's listening live, you can jump in the chat room at podcastufo.com and actually pose a question if you'd like. So you saw your first sighting back in 1956, and you've had a lot of sightings. And do you credit that to the fact that you're always looking up in the sky? And I heard from Chris Lambright that you always make sure you have a video camera with you as well.
Well, a movie camera is what I used to carry constantly.
Yep.
And my first sighting, I had looked from age 9 to age 15 regularly, day and night, from my parents' flat roof garage in Corpus Christi, Texas. Never saw anything I thought was UFOs. I'm not an over-imaginative person. I didn't see one until the cop from across the street called me out and said, Ray Stanford, you've been watching atop that garage for all these years. You better get out here. There's one passing over your house. Me and the neighbors are out here seeing it. And that was on June 10th, 1954. Officer Ritchie, policeman
really?
From across the street. And it began right there. But the truth of the matter is, I'm a very observant person, as evidence. Well, if anybody doubts that, come down to Washington, D.C., to the National Museum of Natural History, Smithsonian Institution, and go to the section called Dinosaurs in the Backyard, and you'll see a picture of me along with my little new species of dinosaur that I found that's on display at the Smithsonian. So I'm an observant person, so I'm observant when I'm looking down, and I'm observant when I'm looking up, and I've trained myself to not scare these things away. There is something that a lot of people do when they have sightings that can actually apparently be sensed by these things and can cause them to leave. But that's another story we can get into if you're interested later on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, ever since I had my sighting, I really, you know, I changed everything. I mean, and I'm always looking up in the sky, whether I'm driving, flying in a plane, doesn't matter where. It really did change, change what I do. And I think that's, you know, that's possibly why a lot of people do not see anything, is because, you know, they're involved in their daily lives and going about their business and not really observing up in the sky.
Well, yes. And what I want people to realize is more of these things are around in daylight than night. They know they're easily spotted at night. So believe it or not, most of their activity around cities and things is in daylight. Keep an eye, keep a camera ready.
Right. So that's it for the first part of the show. And if you'd like to listen to a great segment, listen to Hour 2. And that is with Ray talking about Socorro and some other interesting things and about what he's trying to figure out what to do with all this great evidence that he has. And so I highly recommend the second hour. And you can only get that by supporting the show. So if you'd like to support the show, please go to our website, podcastufo.com, and you'll see right on the sidebar, there'll be a button to click to getjoyride.com. You can support the show for as little as a dollar a month. I have some feedback from some listeners that say they don't want to pay anything per month. They'd rather pay once a year. So I'm going to make that option available. If you'd like to email me about that, just email me at martin@podcastufo.com, and I can arrange that, get that all squared away for a once-a-year subscription. So I want to thank everyone for listening, and I also want to thank the people for helping out. Alejandro Rojas for the news, our guest, of course, and Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for the music, Bruce Rainier for our music as well, and Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. Remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. Next week, we have Space Shuttle Astronaut Story Musgrave. I'm pretty excited about that. And coming up on May 6th, we're going to have a special live show from an office in downtown Portland, Maine. So if you live in Maine and you want to be on the show live, please email me again, once again, at martin@podcastufo.com. You can check us out live next week right here on the Dark Matter Radio Network. And every Wednesday at 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, this is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky.